How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world. During my broadcast, I educate you, the public, on genetic and health topics through news and interviews. Guests include genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, patient advocates, professors, and more. My guests today are from Team Telomere, formerly known as DC Outreach, and their community for telomere biology disorders. This panel includes patient advocate Katie Stevens, Dr. Sharon Savage, and Dr. Sunna Agarwal. They provide information and support services to families worldwide who are affected by these disorders, encourage the medical community's research in finding causes and effective treatments, and facilitate improved diagnosis by educating medical providers. Katie Stevens is the executive director of Team Telomere. Her oldest child, Riley, is affected by a telomere disorder, and Katie's goal is to be an advocate and resource. She's also a member of the Global Genes Foundation Alliance Advisory Council and a National Organization for Rare Disorders, or NORD, member leader. Dr. Sharon Savage is the chief of the clinical genetics branch in the Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics at the National Cancer Institute, NCI. She leads clinical genetic and epidemiology studies of individuals and families that are at a high risk of cancer. She also has a research program in telomere molecular epidemiology that incorporates population-based studies of telomere length and disease with genetic studies of telomere biology, which is what we get into today. She serves as a medical advisor for Team Telomere. My third and final guest is Dr. Sunna Agarwal. He completed his MD and PhD training at Harvard Medical School. He currently has multiple roles as an assistant professor in pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, principal faculty at the Harvard Stem Cell Institute and Harvard Initiative in RNA Medicine, and staff physician in hematopoietic cell transplant at the Dana-Farber Boston Children's Cancer and Blood Disorders Center. His research and clinical work is focused on the mechanisms and treatment of genetic blood disorders. He leads a multi-center bone marrow transplant clinic trial for dyskeratosis congenita, also known as DC, that we refer to in this interview, and his lab is working on a new therapeutic approaches for telomere diseases. He also serves as a medical advisor for Team Telomere. Well, thank you guys for all coming on the show here and sharing your expertise. I want to welcome you to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So my first question is for Katie. What led you to become involved in the patient advocacy community?
I actually was supported by patient advocacy before I ever really became involved with it. My son, through his diagnostic journey, we were put in touch via Facebook with Dyskeratosis Congenita Outreach. And I attended a camp that DCO hosts biannually at Camp Sunshine, and became a board member coming up, I guess, 6 years ago this year. No, 4 years ago this year. And it's just kind of snowballed from there.
And so you were really kind of embraced by the community and wanted to get more involved and give back and everything.
Yeah, they had, DCO had done a presentation at Camp Sunshine, and I just really felt like, one, I've done things for our family, raising funds for, my nephew had a kidney transplant, so I was pretty involved with fundraising for his stay at the Ronald McDonald House, and I had ran races for Leukemia Lymphoma Society, so I felt like I had the tools and background to be able to help give back to this community that was really open-armed to my family.
And so it was kind of a long journey to have your son be diagnosed. Can you take us through where that started and where you guys are today?
Riley was initially diagnosed with aplastic anemia, and they at the time weren't doing genetic testing, frontline genetic testing. They were just testing his siblings to see if they were a match for transplant. And he underwent the therapy for aplastic anemia called ATG because the siblings weren't matches for him, so they were going to try that treatment first. This was in Spokane. He started that treatment on Halloween in 2012. He didn't respond the way they would have liked to have seen him respond. He had some jumps in counts, but that was more likely from the immunosuppression therapy that he was on, because when he would come off of that, his counts would drop. And his hematologist in Spokane had gone to a conference and heard about telomere testing. And he just kept saying, let's just give him 4 more weeks. Let's just give him 4 more weeks and wait for these genetic tests to come back. He ran Riley's telomere tests. They came back very short, and he didn't believe it. So he ran it an additional 3 more times because Riley was very atypical of what they thought someone with shortened telomeres should look like. So that led finally, and discussions were being had in Seattle about what to do, how to transplant Riley properly. We actually were sent to transplant in Seattle, and he had a, I don't know if it was just a really nice bone marrow biopsy that just hit a really nice pocket, but suddenly it looked like he had responded within a 6-week time frame, and he had gone from 10% cellularity to 80% cellularity. And so Seattle told us, fortunately, that he wasn't a candidate for transplant any longer, and they just wanted to watch and wait. So then we got in touch with DC Outreach, and that's where we met Dr. Agarwal, and I got his business card. He had presented his transplant protocol at camp, and I met Dr. Savage there as well and got all of the information for her study. And we went home and just waited, and it took about another year before I was ready to contact Dr. Agarwal in regards to his protocol that he had written for DC patients. And here we are today. Riley's rounding on 3 years post-transplant, doing very well.
And so it took a while of, you know, misdiagnoses to actually get to the real diagnosis.
Yeah. I think he's still kind of in this. What we know for sure is he had short telomeres with aplastic anemia, and that's about as much as we know for Riley. But yeah, it took a lot of back and forth, and nobody believing that this could be something that he had. And not only that, but things were new, and the research was just coming out that, you know, there was a reduced intensity protocol, and nobody knew how to properly transplant Riley until we kind of made the decision as a family what direction we wanted to go in.
And so part of your foundation is the dyskeratosis congenita and telomere biology disorder. So how does this fit in with your son? Is this, you know, what he has and what he's kind of being diagnosed with at the time? Because this seems to be kind of an umbrella disorder.
Yeah, I think we best fall under this umbrella, but he definitely isn't a typical dyskeratosis congenita, which I think Sharon and Sunit would both agree is harder and harder to define anymore, especially the more often physicians are using the telomere testing. We're starting to see it in idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis and much older patients starting to come to DCO. But yes, I would say it's an umbrella organization for sure. We definitely have a broad reach.
And what are your perspectives as doctors now, being able to diagnose this and the process for that and being able to provide proper treatments based on that diagnosis?
Well, if I can jump in here, I think it would help to kind of to give you a little bit of history and put some of this in perspective and how patients' journeys can be so varied across their entire lives and across different ages. dyskeratosis congenita was really first described more than 100 years ago by dermatologists, and that's how it got its name, with dys just meaning abnormal. The keratosis part is related to your keratin, which is in your skin and your nails, and then congenita just means you were born with it. And it was first described in patients who had abnormal finger and toenails, this abnormal skin pigmentation, and oral leukoplakia, which are white spots on the inside of the mouth. And at the same time as those cases were being described, it was also noted that there were very high rates of bone marrow failure or aplastic anemia and other medical complications. And so then over the years, and especially over the last decade, we've really had a growing appreciation for what dyskeratosis congenita and the telomere biology disorders are. The first gene that was identified as causative of dyskeratosis congenita was DKC1, which is an X-linked gene. So that's where the boys are affected and the mom is a carrier. But then as that was evaluated and found to be connected to telomere biology, kind of opened up the doors to identifying more genes. And we're now up to at least 12 or 13 different genes that can cause DC if they have mutations or abnormal variants in them. And then it was sort of the combination of the gene identification and that led us and others to develop the telomere length assay. So that was first developed as a research tool in Vancouver, British Columbia, and then we worked on it to develop it as a diagnostic test. And what we found was that all patients who have DC had very, very short telomeres. And by that, I mean telomeres less than the first percentile for age. So that means 99% of people would have longer telomeres than a patient with DC. And telomeres are really important because they help protect your chromosomes. They're a DNA and protein complex that cap the ends of chromosomes and help keep your DNA stable. We know they shorten with every cell division, and that's a normal part of aging. So a 10-year-old would have much longer telomeres than, say, a 70-year-old. The issue with DC is that these are patients who have very short telomeres for their age, where we could have a 10-year-old with DC does have the telomeres of a 70 or 80-year-old person. And we think that this abnormally short telomeres are what are causing a lot of these other medical problems that we now recognize. So in addition to the skin and nail findings, patients have high rates of bone marrow failure. There's liver disease that can be a complication, high rates and high risk of head and neck squamous cell cancers and of leukemia and myelodysplastic syndrome. And then other medical problems like esophageal stenosis or narrowing of the esophagus, narrowing of the tear ducts, and so this constellation of symptoms can be really variable between patients, even within siblings, and it can make it very difficult to diagnose. And I should add, pulmonary fibrosis is also an important complication of DC.
And so when you're going to diagnose, there's a lot of things that you're kind of taking into consideration. Is it a lot of looking at the telomere length along with, you mentioned the 12 to 13 different genes that have been associated with the disorder? Are you looking at both of those and mutations in those genes to make a diagnosis?
Right. So we're first looking at the patient, right? And we want to look at the medical problems the patient has and the medical problems that their family members have, because that really helps us put it in context as physicians. And then if you suspect someone might have DC or the related telomere biology disorders, then we would do telomere length testing, because that would help confirm the diagnosis, your suspicion. And usually, though, now, because of the rates that it's so easy to, much easier to do genetic testing than it used to be, then most physicians are going straight to doing gene testing, kind of in parallel with the telomere length testing. And the genetic testing for DC with the 13 genes, that will identify, about 70% of patients who have classic DC have a mutation in one of those telomere biology genes. So that can really help firm up the diagnosis. But if you have a patient who you have high clinical suspicion for DC and short telomeres, a negative genetic test doesn't mean that they don't have DC.
Because we may have not identified the gene yet that maybe they have a mutation in.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's something that we and others are working very hard on.
And when you're looking at, you know, symptoms and, you know, looking at the whole picture of not just the testing, as you said, that it's very important to actually, you know, see the patient and meet with them and really be looking at that whole picture. When are some of these symptoms first occurring? Is this something that's happening in mostly children, or are there adults that have had recent symptoms that you're now diagnosing them?
So that is probably the biggest challenge in DC. If you looked up dyskeratosis congenita, and the textbook definition would be that you would have children with the skin and nail findings and the white spots in the mouth and bone marrow failure, typically. They're at the very severe end of the spectrum, there are other what we call variants of DC that also can occur in very young children that have immunodeficiency, so problems fighting infections, and developmental delay, and even some structural brain abnormalities that all are part of this more severe constellation of symptoms. A challenge as a clinician and as a patient trying to deal with this is that we also have people at the other end of the spectrum who may have isolated or pulmonary fibrosis or just aplastic anemia that present later in life, even at 40, 50 years old. And those patients are overall less severe because they didn't have symptoms in childhood, but they still are part of the telomere biology disordered DC spectrum of disease, because when we look at their genes and their telomere length, we see a common biology.
With this, it's obviously usually, is that something that you find also with this disorder, that patients that are diagnosed later really could have benefited from that, say 20, 30 years ago?
That's a good question. I like the idea of early diagnosis because I want to kind of be able to follow patients and have an idea of trends and know what's going on. And especially because of the cancer susceptibility, and I'm a pediatric oncologist, so I'm very much into cancer prevention and early detection. So it is important for early diagnosis because you can do some amount of cancer screening. And really importantly, you can do a better job of informing the patient and the family what might occur.
And Dr. Agarwal, I wanted to get your take on all this as well, of how many people are affected by this disorder. Is this a rare disorder, and how rare are we talking?
So I think that in its classic form, dyskeratosis congenita, as Dr. Savage described, is a rare disease. There are probably, it's safe to say, less than 1,000 people in the United States, probably more on the order of low hundreds, who are affected with the classic form of the disease. But also very importantly, what's been pointed out is that that is the tip of the iceberg. These are patients who are presenting early in childhood with multi-system disease due to a relatively severe telomere biology disorder. And the spectrum, as it extends into older and older patients, probably constitutes one or two orders of magnitude increased numbers of patients. So we're probably talking about thousands of patients then who might have a genetic disorder of telomere biology that contributes in some way to medical problems over the course of their lives. And the majority of those patients will probably be adults when they present. So this is something that's emerging. This is something that we're learning, and we're trying to get a sense of the actual burden of the disease, but it's already becoming apparent that what we were calling dyskeratosis congenita was the rarer and earlier onset form of a spectrum of disease that spans greater numbers of people and a very wide age range.
And so with that, do you think that a lot of people are not being diagnosed with this and it's underdiagnosed?
I think that one of the party line probably right now is that the majority of people who are seeing these patients, whether they be pediatricians who are seeing patients with dyskeratosis congenita or adult physicians seeing patients who have a telomere biology disorder that's manifesting in a different way, don't know about these diseases and don't know to look for them and to screen for them. And that is changing. It's changing certainly on the pediatric side with respect to patients who present with bone marrow failure or failure of the blood system. And it's starting to creep into the thought process, I think, of looking at these genetic causes of disease in adults who have previously been thought to be completely healthy and now come in their 40s or 50s with respiratory symptoms or a liver disease or new onset blood cancer. And again, I think it's emerging as we speak what the burden of disease is in these age ranges. It's not going to be common like diabetes or heart disease, but it's probably more common than we think. And part of the process is to educate the physicians also to be looking for these disorders.
And I would add that, you know, I absolutely agree. I think it's really been unrecognized and because we didn't have the diagnostic test. And it's something that we're working very hard to really try to understand and educate physicians of all specialties to really start being on the lookout, to start thinking about it. And I think that once we once we identify more genes and do as genetic testing becomes more and more commonplace, we're going to find that more people have genetic variants in these genes that may or may not be important in their clinical manifestations.
And so sometimes it's kind of sorting through that genetic information of, is this variant significant? Is it not significant? And where does it fall on the spectrum of disease and things like that, and if it's something that maybe it's not linked to disease.
Right, and that's a whole other topic in and of itself that the genetics community is really working on now.
And so what is the latest research that's happening right now in the past couple years?
I think in addition to an expanding number of genetic findings, one of the things that's been very interesting, I think from the beginning in dyskeratosis congenita in particular, is that some of the genes that have been found in the patients are indicating a role of those genes that had previously unknown or differently thought of functions in telomere biology. So the patient mutations are actually informing basic human biology. And that's then reflexing into thinking of how you can come up with strategies to try to intervene. So with the knowledge of different genetic etiologies for dyskeratosis congenita, you get not only a diagnostic tool, but also some insights into how to perhaps modulate and change telomere biology and telomerase, which is very useful in a research context, but also gives some ideas of how to treat these diseases. And I'd say one other thing, that because telomere biology is fundamental to everyone, not just for patients who actually have mutations in these pathways, there are broader implications for understanding how to manipulate these pathways in for a variety of diseases that are beyond just the genetic forms of DC and telomere diseases.
And I would add too, I think we've really, the scientific community, from the work that so many people have done with the patients and identifying their genes, has really uncovered new and really exciting aspects of telomere biology that I think were really unappreciated or unknown at the time. And so I think as we fine-tune that understanding, we'll be better able to hopefully make advances in clinical management of patients with DC. Because as I tell all of our patients, a really important part of understanding their gene is that if we don't know what's wrong, if we don't know why something's broken, we can't fix it. And identifying the genetic causes is really the first step in trying to understand what's going on in our patients.
How do you guys help families who are affected by this disorder and other related?
Our main focus as far as families go are making sure that they first feel supported. When you're talking about a rare disease, when my son was initially diagnosed, we had one of the social workers look at me and say, you're going to find yourself being a little tiny island in an ocean of cancer. And what that meant was there wasn't a lot of support for what he had. And we found over and over again that patients are denied things, you know, support from a variety of places. because they don't have the proper diagnosis. And so it's our job to, one, you know, catch them when they fall between the cracks. And that means meeting them wherever they are in their journey, whether they're heading to transplant or they've, you know, already gone through transplant and things are progressing, making sure that they know that we're there. So what that means is, you know, like the camp that I discussed, my family went to is a life-changing event for our families. They get to meet about 25 other families and be in front of, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 specialists in the disease, whereas if you live in a rural community, nobody knows this disease, and suddenly you're put right in front of the people that understand the disease. And the kids get to go just be kids, and they get to talk about things if they want to talk about things. I know my son had a friend who said, can you just tell me what it's like to go through bone marrow transplant? And for them to be able to have that moment where they can get it from their peer and not from, you know, an adult or a physician telling them this is what it's like when they actually don't know what it's like I just think it's one of the best things DCO does. And then the other thing that we're very proud of is we do a care package program, and it really took off last year. We've been able to do, we're rounding on 80 care packages, this month. And we're talking about, we only support really that we know of about 300 families globally. And that means even our bereaved community as well. And in those care packages, we've had people volunteer their time and their resources making blankets. And we stick in a water bottle because typically the kidneys take a hit if they've gone through transplant and they need to drink a lot of water. So we want them to have something that's just for them. And anyway,
we just try to... It must feel really good to kind of have that support network and to... you know, turn to each other as resources of someone that's actually been through this and not just reading a web page about it.
Yes, I would say that. Yesterday, actually, in one of the Facebook chat groups, a mom posted how inspired she was to give back because she just really felt like there was nobody else out there that understands this process, whether, and it's such a, it's a disease that doesn't stop. So it's relentless and it keeps going until, you know, their bodies can't take anymore. And so it's an amazing support group.
And so important to have as, you know, a family that's going through these things. And I can't imagine how much you're able to, you know, relate to each other, but, you know, just human to human, really, when it comes down to it, of being there for each other during those, you know, really challenging times.
Yeah. I think so. And I think the neat thing about the organization, and I'll say this about Dr. Agarwal and Dr. Savage and other members of our medical board, is they feel that support both on the outreach side of things and the medical side of things. We've all been able to connect on a really, like you say, humanistic level. You know, it's all medical and it's all stuff that it's daunting, but we all are in this together. And I think we're all, you know, kind of standing shoulder to shoulder, both on the advocacy side and the medical side to better the lives of our patients.
Well, and I think too, one of the best things that also has come out of DC Outreach is the educational efforts they're making for the physicians and scientists, and mm-hmm. being at conferences and sharing the information they have, sharing the guidelines book, and really they've really becoming a resource for physicians as well.
Yeah, we did try to kind of change. It's always been there. It's always been a part of the mission, but we really wanted to strategize how best to do that. We've been able to give out over 300 guidelines just in between December and May to physicians and researchers. And when I hand over a guideline at a conference, I look at the physician and I say, you know, we're physician support too, because when you come across a patient that has this disease, it's not fair to you or the patient that you be in this alone. So we want them to feel supported and to know that they have a resource in us as well.
Which is fantastic to have that kind of dual approach of, you know, being there for patients and their families, but also really getting physicians involved in the conversation like we have today of, you know, really raising awareness on both sides and saying, okay, we don't just want you to know about this disease. We want you to know, you know, how to treat, how to diagnose, and different resources to point patients to. And so how can people become a bone marrow donor and other ways to get involved and help?
Well, I can speak to the bone marrow donor part. So probably the best and most efficient way is to go to bethematch.org, where you can sign up to be a bone marrow donor, and you'll join millions of people on a registry. It's pretty simple. It doesn't involve giving blood. It involves answering some questions about your health. And then it's based on that information that you may be contacted in the future to potentially have other testing done if you look like you might be a match for a patient. So that's a very, very important thing to do, because one of the basic limitations of bone marrow donation is that there aren't enough match donors out there. The other ways of engaging are if there happen to be a bone marrow drive near you. There usually are in people's communities because someone's affected by a blood cancer and these are going on. But if one wants to be proactive about it, then the National Marrow Donor Program at bethematch.org is the place to go.
And any other ways that people can get involved directly with you guys at DC Outreach?
Yeah, I would say the best place to go is to start at dcoutreach.org, our website, and lots of ways to give back. We have a scientific grant that we're currently raising money for through the $1 million bike ride, and our team is Team Josh. And Dr. Agarwal was actually our first recipient of a $50,000 grant, and we were able to give another $50,000 grant out to Dr. Johnson in Philadelphia. So that's a really great way to be proactive with our community.
Which is fantastic that all the work you guys are doing, and that you're really making just a huge difference in so many different people's lives. Follow them on Twitter at Team Telomere, and also teamtelomere.org is their new website, so go check it out. Also wanted to point you to marrowfailure.cancer.gov as another resource that you can look at for more information. All of these links that we're talking about are going to be on dnapodcast.com. You can follow me on Twitter at dnapodcast, Instagram at dnaradio. And questions, anyone on today's panel, myself, or inquiries can be sent to info@dnapodcast.com. So thank you guys for coming on. Really appreciate you sharing, you know, your expertise, and Katie, your personal family's journey through all of this, and all of the patient advocacy work that you've been doing.
Thank you for having us, Kara.
Thanks very much.
That's great. Yep.
Yeah, thank you.
So thanks for listening, guys. Join me next week to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.